Well, Paul asked me if we were going to spend much time talking about baptism. I said, well, it kind of depends on who's here. And Kathy had said that she was going to be here tonight, and she's not. So I'm not going to spend as much time talking about baptism as I might have otherwise. But I think as we look at the context of this statement that's made, or these statements that are made about baptism in the latter portion of this third paragraph in 1 Corinthians chapter 1, we need to put it in the frame of reference that the divisions in the church at Corinth apparently were the result of partyism. And that is that there were certain individuals there, and I don't know who they were, because Paul doesn't name them. And in fact, in chapter 4, he says that he transferred his own name and Apollos. In a figurative sense, he used his name in place of the culprits in the church at Corinth. So we don't know who they were, but it appears that the following of these individuals was not so much doctrinal as it was infatuation with the individuals. And so it could be, and I think there's a reasonable possibility, it could be that these individuals who had their own little agenda would say, well, you know, Peter would approve of what I'm doing. And another guy would say, well, Paul would approve of what I'm doing. And another guy might say, well, you know, I've got the approval of what Christ would endorse by what I'm doing. And so if that's the scenario, and I think based upon what we're going to be talking about tonight, and that is chapter 1:18 through chapter 2, verse 5, I think we're going to see that probably is what was underlying this whole matter of the divisions in the church at Corinth. That they were gathering their own little groups, and they were espousing their doctrine or philosophy, probably the wisdom. It was more human wisdom. And so they were probably suggesting that, well, you know, Peter would have gone along with this, or Paul or Apollos or whatever. Because otherwise I don't see the point in the intense rebuttal of Paul to human wisdom that we're going to read about in chapter 1:18 and following. So another thing that could factor into this, again, if these fellows are trying to solicit endorsement of some big name apostle, is that, well, you know what? I was baptized by Peter. I was baptized by whoever. You know, as if that's going to make a lot of difference. Even today, I've heard Christians sometimes talk about who baptized them. And I wonder, not in every case, and probably in very few cases, but I think in some cases it's been in an effort to say, well, you know what? I've got to be right because so-and-so baptized me. You know, and that could be some of what's going on here. In fact, I suspect that it was. And so Paul makes it very clear that his mission was not just to go out and baptize people so that he could either make a great claim about how many people he baptized, or so that a bunch of people could say, well, you know what, Paul baptized me. No, his mission was to preach the gospel. Now, that's not to say that baptism is not relevant. But this expression here in verse 17, for Christ sent me not to baptize, but to preach the gospel, has been grossly abused by the proponents of the faith-only doctrine. Because they'll run to this verse and they'll say, well, see, Paul said that he wasn't supposed to baptize. You know, he was just out there to preach the gospel. this is a classic use of what's called second-degree comparison. And if you wanted to put an ellipsis in here, literally it is, for Christ sent me not to baptize primarily. That was not his main mission. That was not the main focus of what he was doing. The main focus was preach the gospel. Now, baptism goes along with the gospel. But it is a matter of that which is of first priority. Sometimes those second-degree comparison statements are rendered, Christ sent me not to baptize only, but to preach the gospel. But from my study of it, it's more of a first and second-degree comparison. That is, what's most important? What is the main point? Preaching the gospel. Okay. Of course, we know that's what Jesus told his disciples to do. Everything else follows that. Exactly. Preaching the gospel then includes belief and repentance and confession and baptism and discovery. Nancy?
Well, in Acts 2, you've got 2,000 people. 5,000 altogether have been baptized. Well, to stay around and baptize that many people, your job is to go up to the next town and preach the gospel. That's what we're saying here. The people that responded
or Peter's in the case of Acts 2. So
in verse 13 there, he said, ask is Christ divided? And then his qualification, was I crucified for you?
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's one thing that had to happen. The other thing is, were you baptized in Paul? You know, he affirming the fact that baptism is essential there. But only into those to be crucified for you is Christ.
Yeah. And it would be in the name of Christ. Name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, as Jesus said in Matthew 28. So this is not a passage to prove the non-essentiality of baptism. And then he said in the middle part of verse 17, not in the wisdom of words, lest the cross of Christ should be made void or nullified. So here is what I was talking about a while ago. That this seems to be one of the big problems with regard to this division. And that is human wisdom. And so what Paul's going to do from verse 18 on is through chapter 2, verse 5, is he's going to lay out three key points that prove his proposition, and that is that the preaching of the gospel is not in human wisdom. It's not based upon human reasoning or human wisdom. And I'll give you the three main points, and then we'll go back and dissect them. But the first one is just stop and take a look at the message. Who in the world would ever have dreamed up a scheme of redemption based upon God coming in the flesh, dying on a cross, being buried in a tomb and raised from the tomb and exalted back to heaven? You talk about far-fetched, that's about the most unreasonable scheme that, probably wouldn't even cross the mind of anybody, much less be a part of God's plan. So, human wisdom contrasted with the message of the gospel. Secondly, human wisdom, especially among the Greeks, attracted a very elite clientele. I mean, if you wanted to be somebody, just become a follower of some great Greek philosopher. You know, Plato had his school and Socrates had his school, and in this period of time there were a number of other great thinkers of the day. And so if you were one of their followers, then that suggested that, well, you were in the in crowd. And so what Paul says, okay, again, that is what human wisdom perceives as being the way to go. As opposed to, look at the people who responded to the gospel. Talk about opposite ends of the spectrum. I mean, you can't get further apart than the intelligentsia of the Greek philosophers versus the common, quote, nobodies, unquote, that were typical of those who responded to the gospel. So, and there's another nail in the coffin of the idea that human wisdom has to be the basis for this appeal, as opposed to the plain, simple truth of the gospel. And then the third point that Paul makes is, again, it's in the context of the eloquent speakers that espouse the Greek philosophy. Well, they talk about silver-tongued orators. They were, maybe their silver tongues were gold-plated. I don't know. But well, they were smooth talkers. And Paul said, not me. Not me. So, those are the three points that he draws on to support his proposition in verse 17, and that is that he did not preach, the gospel that he preached was not the product of human wisdom. And he said, the reason for that is lest the cross of Christ should be made void, or this rendering, and I've got a new version that I started putting up. It's the English Majority Text version. I was talking with a friend of mine who's a Greek scholar, and I said, "Okay, if you were gonna pick a Greek text to hang your hat on, and of course the fact of the matter is there's no one single Greek text that you can say, okay, this is the one." But I said, if you were gonna pick one, and I had already read this somewhere else, I said, which one would you take? And he said, well, probably the majority text has the least questions and issues about it. But the problem with it is there's not any Bible programs that use it, and there's not many translations out there that you can find of it. So anyway, I thought I'd throw it up there. And because it just gives us a little different slant. So anyway, he said, lest the cross of Christ should be deprived of its power or nullified or made void. Now, why would the cross of Christ be deprived of its power if the preaching was oriented toward human wisdom? Okay. It's not, you know, it's not our ideas. It's not man's way. It's God's way. And so if you start trying to appease the philosophers and appease those who are enthralled with human wisdom, which, and the reason I'm saying this is because there's a lot of that sort of thing done today, is sort of blending them together. And of course, anytime you blend truth with human wisdom, you come up with what the technical term is syncretism. It's just nothing more than a pollution of truth. Well, you can't blend human wisdom with the cross of Christ. Otherwise, you're saying, in effect, forget the cross of Christ. You know, let's put the emphasis on this human wisdom. And Paul said, didn't do that. He preached the pure, unadulterated gospel.
Anything but that nullifies.
He does.
Because if you start bringing in things that we see in the denominational world, we see it in the church.
Oh, yeah?
People start bringing in things, and it moves them out of the realm of what God said.
I know I know some preachers who pursued their academic education and got PhDs, doctors of theology, and there's nothing inherently wrong with that. Don't misunderstand me. However, the temptation seems to be that those guys got the, the ones I'm thinking of, got the big head, and also people started putting them up on pedestals. Well, he's got a PhD. He's got a theology, doctorate and whatever. And so whatever he says must be right. Well, it may be and it may not be, but it's not because he has any advanced education. It's because the Lord said it. That's the bottom line. That's what makes it right or wrong. And so there's a bit of a danger there in that sort of thing. But Al, did you have your hand up?
Yeah, usually when a man thinks, they think of physical and earthly things and not spiritual. And that's what God thinks is spiritual. Jesus spoke to them, spoke about that quite often. He told them, don't just fight it. My kingdom is not of this world. It's spiritual.
Yep. One of the statements I read in a commentary on this recently was the ultimate expression of idolatry is human wisdom, because it's self exaltation. Man setting himself up in the place of God.
Would you tie Romans 1:16-17 in every time?
Now, you notice verse 18 starts with the little F-O-R. So this is point number one in his proposition, and that is that he preaches the gospel, not the words, wisdom of words. For the word, which goes back to the wisdom of words. So you've got a contrast here. You've got the wisdom of words, human wisdom, versus what? The word, same term in the original, logos, of the cross. So you got the cross versus human wisdom. Okay? I'm not blending them together, but it's either or. The word of the cross is to them that perish, literally, are perishing. I notice they rendered that in the present participle there, are perishing, but to us who are being saved, both of those, in fact, the footnote in my Bible has them as present participles. Those that are perishing, it's foolishness, but unto us who are being saved, that are saved, it is the power of God. So right out of the gate here, you notice that the attitude toward the cross. And when he says the cross, and all the way through here, when he talks about the cross, he's not talking about that thing. He's talking about the scheme of redemption. That's just a metaphor for the scheme of redemption. The theme of the Bible is we're teaching our youngsters in the Shaping Hearts. Jesus is coming, Jesus is here, Jesus is coming again. The death, burial, resurrection of Christ. Romans 1:16, the power of the gospel to save people's souls. That is the cross he's talking about. The word of the cross, the message of the cross. To those people that are perishing, it is utter foolishness. Word fool means silly, ridiculous. Just, they scoff at it, turn their nose. Why, that's the dumbest thing I've ever heard. Sure doesn't appeal to human wisdom. On the other hand, those that are being saved, it's the power of God. Again, Romans 1:16. The gospel is the power of God unto salvation. So, he wouldn't have to say anything else to prove his point. That is, that the gospel that he preached was certainly not tied into human wisdom, the words of human wisdom. Now, the fact that he preached it doesn't make it so, inherently. But I'll tell you what does prove that he was preaching what was right is because this is what God said was going to happen. So he runs back to the Old Testament and he pulls out a passage from Isaiah chapter 29 that he says applies to the point that he's making. Now let's look back there for just a moment at Isaiah 29. Because this is such a powerful point in the argument that he's making, the evidence that he's presenting to prove his proposition. In the context of Isaiah 29, this is referencing the time when Assyria was bearing down upon Judah. And so it's a message to Jerusalem. Now, if you go back to 2 Kings chapter 19, you find the incident that the prophet's talking about. You might remember Rabshakeh, who was a captain of the Assyrian army. He came and he taunted Jerusalem and taunted Hezekiah and said, you dummies, you're relying upon that old broken stick or reed called Egypt, and you think your God's going to take care of you. You just take a look. You know, you take a look at what this army's done and how we've run over everybody and how, boy, nobody's been able to defeat us. I mean, you guys better be shaking in your boots. Say, boy, you're toast. Now, that's a kind of a loose paraphrase of what he said. But the Lord said through Isaiah, verse 6 of chapter 19, thus you shall say to your master, thus says the Lord, do not be afraid because of the words that you've heard with which the servants of the king of Assyria have blasphemed me. Behold, I will put a spirit in him so that he shall hear a rumor and return to his own land, and I will make him fall by the sword in his own hand. You don't have to worry because I'm on your side. Now, if you go over to verse 35, you find out what happened that kind of got Sennacherib's attention, king of Assyria. Then it happened that night that an angel of the Lord went out and struck 185,000 in the camp of the Assyrians. And when the men arose early in the morning, behold, all of them were dead. So Sennacherib, the king of Assyria, departed and returned home and lived in Nineveh. And I don't get the idea that he just kind of said, oh, well, you know, I don't think this is going to work out. Maybe we all just go home and watch TV. I suspect that he hit the road running when 185,000 of his men were slain by an angel. Now, let's tie this back into the context of 1 Corinthians 1. Conventional warfare tactics, conventional tactics in warfare against the city. Oh, you build these war machines and you get all your, you know, troops gathered up and you push these big old machines up there and they throw rocks and fire and the guys get up there and shoot their arrows and all that kind of stuff. As opposed to an angel killing 185,000. Now, which fits the typical scenario of human wisdom when it comes to warfare? Well, duh, it's not the angel killing the 185,000. Now, that's the context of the statement that's made in Isaiah chapter 29 and verse 14, which Paul quotes here, for it is written, I will destroy the wisdom of the wise, and the discernment of the discerning will I bring to naught. Yeah, the wisdom of the wise would never have said, hey, I know what, let's just ask the Lord to send his angel to kill those guys. Huh? Now, the wisdom of the wise was shown to be folly. Rab Shuka was saying, boy, what, you better, if you can't fight, boy, you better give in. No. Because the Lord's ways always have been contrary to the ways of human wisdom. That's why statements like, you know, Jeremiah 10:23 and Proverbs 14:12 and other statements are made in the Scriptures. It is not within man to direct his own steps, because man is not going to be able to figure it out, because he doesn't think like God. He doesn't operate like God. So that's the point that Paul's making here. You look back at what happened in the case of Assyria and when they were surrounding Jerusalem and what God said about that, the wisdom of the wise is going to be destroyed. And he said, that principle worked then. It applies to what we're talking about here when it comes to the preaching of the gospel. Human wisdom is out. Now, again, keep thinking about what was going on in Corinth and the problems that they were having with these guys and the divisions that were resulting. So, Paul would say then, in verse 20, yeah, in light of what he just quoted from what God said in Isaiah 29, okay, where is the wise? You think anybody's going to stand up? Oh, I'm here, you know, it's me. I'm a wise man, after he just got through proving that God said that he's going to destroy the wisdom of the wise. No, no way. And where is the scribe or the expert in the law? That's what the scribes were viewed as, the law expert, the one that could run to the book and say, okay, here it is. And, of course, they were renowned for their knowledge, but their knowledge was not married to wisdom, not divine or spiritual wisdom. They were sticklers of the letters of the law, but the thought and heart of the law was foreign to them. And where's the disputer or the debater of this world? And, you know, the Greeks loved, you know, a good debate. They're on Mars Hill, you know, they loved to hear something new and all that Paul encountered whenever he was in Athens in Acts 17. Okay, you know, bring up your greatest debater and let's just put him to the test. I mean, that's the idea here in this question that Paul is raising. Okay, you know, if you think I'm wrong, bring him on. Hath not God made foolish the wisdom of the world? Of course he has. Besides the Assyrian incident over and over and over again, you can think of the numerous times that God has put man in his place. Think about the Nebuchadnezzar going out and, you know, eating grass. And, you know, on and on we could go. Talk about Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. You know, all of those great stories in the Old Testament. Well, then, obviously, that's a rhetorical question. Absolutely, he sure has. For, verse 21, seeing that in the wisdom of God, the world through its wisdom knew not God. Well, it can know some things, but you're not going to know God as a result of sitting down and listening to Socrates or Plato or Herodotus or, you know, whoever. Not going to happen. And it was the good pleasure of God through the foolishness of the preaching to save them that believe. Why would he call what he had already said that he preached foolishness of preaching. In what sense is it foolishness? Exactly. Yeah. That's the way these great thinkers were looking at it. Remember, Paul was accused of losing his mind. Have you gone mad? And, you know, I've got a true confession to make. I get Festus and Felix mixed up. I can't remember. I never can remember who's who. I think it was Felix that said that. Wasn't it? Or was it Festus? Hmm. It's Festus. Well, yeah, no, but then I couldn't remember the hook. You know, I couldn't remember what it is I was supposed to remember so that I could remember what it is I was trying to remember. Okay. Well, it's Festus.
It's easier just to say the one that started with that.
Okay. Well, it was Festus, all right, in Acts 26. Festus saith unto him with a loud voice. I mean, this is after he talked about, you know, brought up the resurrection. Paul, thou art mad. Thy much learning has turned thee mad. Paul said unto him, I'm not mad, most excellent Festus, but speak forth words of truth and soberness. So, yeah, Festus is one of those kind that said, you've lost your mind. What are you talking about? The foolishness of what you're saying, silliness, ridiculous. Well, that's what God chose, that message, to put to shame the wisdom of the world and provide for the salvation of men's souls. So through Christ and the gospel of Jesus Christ, this is the message that Paul preached. Now, he's going to cover two different groups here that say this is foolishness, it's silly, it's ridiculous. And one are the Jews. Verse 22. Four. Okay, here's why some of them say it's foolishness. Four. Seeing the Jews ask for signs. How many times did the Jews ask Jesus to show them a sign? Okay, you just prove to us that your claim is accurate. Well, they weren't asking for proof. They just thought maybe they could trip him up because they didn't like what he was saying, and so they weren't going to believe him regardless of what he said or what he did. And you remember the incident with the rich man and Lazarus, and you know, rich man says, well, you know, just, you know, go back down there and tell my brothers about this. And Jesus said, they've got Moses and the prophets. If they were going to believe, they would believe on the basis of what Moses the prophet said, but even if one rises from the dead, they're not going to believe. No, because to them, a crucified Messiah is utter foolishness. They were, I guess they had ripped Isaiah 53 out of their Bibles. Or they had done what Jesus said. They put their blinders on and they closed their ears and they didn't pay attention to what it was saying. So, the Jews think it's foolishness because they're looking for a sign, but they're looking, what was the sign they were looking for? What sign that they already decided the Messiah would use to prove that he was the Christ. Yep, that's right. Kick Rome back to Italy and set up their own kingdom and rule the world from Jerusalem. Come riding in on his white horse. And that's the only sign they were interested in seeing. And then the Gentile, then the Greeks. They seek after wisdom. Well, we've already talked a lot about human wisdom. So you've got human wisdom again versus God's wisdom. But, verse 23, but we preach Christ crucified, unto the Jews a stumbling block, and unto the Gentiles foolishness. But unto them that are called, called by what? The gospel. 2 Thessalonians 2:14. We talked about that last week. Both Jews and Greeks, Christ the power of God and the wisdom of God. So power, wisdom in the gospel. Romans 1:16 again. It's all the way through here in the background. Gospel, the power of God into salvation. Jews and Greeks, either one, doesn't matter. If they are receptive to the call, if they open their minds and they open their hearts and they look at what the Bible said, how Jesus proved to be the fulfillment of the scriptures pointing to the Messiah, as he said himself in Luke 24, you know, things that are written in the law of Moses and the Psalms and the prophets concerning me, he said, I have fulfilled all of those things. You look at the evidence, and voila, you've got all you need to know about the power and the wisdom of God. But the foolishness of God is wiser than men, and the weakness of God is stronger than men. So what God did was foolishness? Well, again, as Nancy pointed out, from the standpoint of human wisdom, it appears to be. But now again, Paul's making that polarized comparison from one end of the spectrum to the other. You take the wisdom of men, compare it to what God did. Okay. The wisest man, the wisest men on the planet, whatever they can concoct or dream up, or whatever they can do, in comparison to what God does, it pales in comparison, because even the tiniest little thing that God would do far exceeds what some man can do. So the foolishness of God here, I believe, is just a metaphor of saying, you know, the least little thing that God would do is so much greater than what the greatest thing that men could ever dream of. And saying, again, the weakness of God, it's stronger than men. Or whatever appears to be weakness. And if you want to look at it from the standpoint of the cross, again, that appears to be weakness to men. But bottom line is, everything that God did in the fulfillment of the scheme of redemption and the cross, death, burial, resurrection of Christ, it's not even on the same planet as the wisest philosopher of Paul's day or any other man that wants to brag about his human wisdom. Not even remotely. So, the message of the cross proves his proposition. It's proven by the scriptures in the Old Testament, and it's proven by its comparison to what men were looking for. Nancy.
But you have to keep that whole message intact.
Yep.
Because if you start pulling it out of context, then any one part doesn't make sense.
Okay. Anything else on the 3 verse 25? So you notice the verse 26. Four? Oh. So this is point number two. proving his proposition that he stated in verse 17. For behold your calling. All right, let's just look around. Okay, we've talked about the message. All right, now let's just look around and see the results. Not many wise after the flesh. That is, all these guys that want to brag about who they learned their great ideas from and all these wonderful men of wisdom, sure don't see many of them in the crowd. And not many mighty, powerful, you know, macho, great leaders. Don't see many of them.
The early ones were efficient.
Yeah. Yeah, just nobody's almost.
They were Galilean. That was even worse.
That was even worse then, right. And not many noble. No, the upper crust are called. Now, you know, the Calvinist wants to look at these all called verses and say, okay, see, God has already decided who is and who isn't. No, everybody's called by the gospel, but not everybody is receptive to it. We're talking about the recipients. But God chose the foolish things of the world. Again, from human wisdom standpoint, we've already talked about that in the previous paragraph. That so that he might put to shame them that are wise. They can't appeal to their philosophies and their human wisdom and say, okay, yeah, this squares with that. No way in the world you could ever get the two to harmonize. They're poles apart. And he chose the weak things of the world. The Galilean fishermen. Why, you remember in Acts 2? Who are these guys? Well, they're Galileans. They don't know anything. They're just a bunch of dumb fishermen. That he might put to shame the things that are strong. And the base things of the world, just common, ordinary, you know, not fancy, not the, you know, glitz and the glamour, that the things that are despised and the things that are despised did God choose, yea, and the things that are not, that is, things that are just like nothing, just as far as men's valuation is concerned, they're zilch. That so that he might bring to naught the things that are, that is, the human wisdom and all of the things that go with the appeal of power and strength and prestige. God chose a way that puts all those things at the other end of the spectrum, and so you can't say, well, there, you know, we can kind of work this out. No, it's either or. It's not that stuff. It's this way, this simple, unreasonable, common, weak way. Again, if you're looking at it as a man. Why? Verse 29. So that no flesh could glory before God. Nobody could stand up and say, well, I figured this thing out. Or I got it because of who I am. Or because I'm just so great and so powerful and so wise and on and on. Nope, nobody, absolutely nobody who is being saved could make a claim like that. Because God made sure that all of the elements that are attendant to the plan of salvation, there's not a single solitary one of them that would play into that kind of an appeal, either, you know, wisdom, power, strength, etc. In fact, it shows how utterly useless those things are. not one particle of any one of those things is going to ingratiate God to you. But of Him are ye in Christ, who was made into us wisdom from God in righteousness and sanctification and redemption. So in connection with Christ, God's plan, and the result of what He did, look at what was accomplished. Righteousness, sanctification, redemption. That, so that, according as it is written, He that glorieth, let him glory in the Lord, not in human wisdom, strength, power, da-da-da-da-da. It all is tied to God, what He has done and accomplished in Christ. And by the way, the righteousness, sanctification, and redemption are all things that occur at the same time when you obey the gospel. Not like the denominational people want to teach, that it's a process that, you know, these are separate events that come in strung out over a period of time. And this all goes back to the very thing that God had said in Jeremiah 9, and we don't have time. I'm surprised those classes aren't in now. We'll go back, but you might want to go back and read Jeremiah 9, 23 and 24, because what Jeremiah said there is precisely the point that Paul is making in this paragraph about those that are going to be the followers of Christ and the redeemed.
We got that one
there. Yeah.
Verse 27.
Mm-hmm.
God had chosen foolish things in the world to confound the wise. And one of the things that I always think about when we get is the argument for evolution.
Yeah.
And how every time they turn around, they have to change it because something else is coming in.
Oh, uh-huh. Uh-huh. Yeah.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. That's for sure.
Okay. Are you willing to proceed from that point?